This podcast is brought to you by the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, ACAM for short. You can find more podcasts and other resources on our website, www.acamh.org, and follow us on social media by searching ACAMH.
Hello, welcome to the In Conversation podcast series for the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, or ACAM for short. I'm Jo Carlo, a freelance journalist with a specialism in psychology, and I have with me Atgaga Sabian, Assistant Professor at the Departments of Paediatrics, Population Health and Environmental Medicine at NYU School of Medicine, and Dr. Tonya White, Professor at the Department of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry at Erasmus University Medical Center, Rotterdam. Atgar and Tonya are co-authors of the paper Adolescent Gender Diversity, Socio-Demographic Correlates and Mental Health Outcomes in the General Population, recently published in the Journal of Child Psychology and Psychiatry. The JCPP is one of the three journals produced by the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health. ACAM also produces JCPP Advances and The CAM. If you're a fan of our In Conversation series, please subscribe on your preferred streaming platform. Let us know how we did with a rating or review, and do share with friends and colleagues. Atgar and Tonya, welcome. Can you start with a brief introduction about yourselves?
Hi, thank you, Jo. I'm delighted to be here. I'm Atgaga Sabian. I'm an epidemiologist, assistant professor of pediatrics and population health at New York University at New York City. And my research is about environmental determinants of child neurodevelopment. We basically follow up children and their families from very early stages of life through childhood, adolescence, and young adulthood. And we study how life experiences shape the development of brain and influence children's mental health.
Brilliant. And Tonya?
Yes, I'm also delighted to be here. I'm Tonya White. I'm a pediatrician, a child and adolescent psychiatrist, and I moved from the U.S. About 12 years ago to set up a pediatric population neuroimaging program within Generation R study at Erasmus University Medical Center here in Rotterdam. And my area of research involves really this intersection between epidemiology and developmental neuroscience, encompassing the interplay between brain, cognition, and behavior.
Great. Thank you very much. Let's turn to the paper, Adolescent Gender Diversity, Socio-Demographic Correlates and Mental Health Outcomes in the General Population, published in the JCPP. What did you look at in this study? Can you give us a summary of the paper?
The study is about gender diversity in young adolescents within the general population. Current data show that the number of youths who are referred to gender clinics because of gender dysphoria has increased over the past decade. Overall, we know that about 1-3% of youth self-identify as transgender or gender non-confirming. But gender diversity has a broad definition, including but not limited to variant gender identity, gender expression, and exists in the general population. And another important point to consider is that gender diversity can be present at very young age. But how to measure gender diversity in young adolescents has been a challenge for researchers. Some researchers ask parents about gender variant behaviors, and some others frame the question in a way that adolescents can understand and can answer themselves. So in this project, our goal was to estimate the prevalence of gender variant experiences as reported by both young adolescents and their parents, and also to find the stability over time and the agreement between parent and children. We also examined the association of gender variant experiences with social demographic factors, as you mentioned, and mental health outcome in children.
And what methodology did you use for the research?
I can address that, but I want to give a little bit of background first, because I think it's helpful to understand the methodology when you also understand the context of the study. So between 2002 and 2006, about 10,000 women were recruited into the Generation R study, which is an epidemiological study with the goals of assessing child development over time and multiple aspects of child development as well. The only inclusion criteria for the study were women needed to be pregnant and they needed to live within certain zip codes. And so it is truly a population-based sort of epidemiological study. Rotterdam in the Netherlands is quite ethnically diverse. It's the largest port city in Europe. And approximately 60% of the families are still participating from the initial recruitment. So it's one of the nice aspects of having these large population-based studies in Northern Europe is that they're well conducted on this side of the pond, so to speak, being an American living in the Netherlands. So what we did was we surveyed adolescents, actually starting between age 9, older school-age children and adolescents about gender variant experiences and also mental health outcomes. We did that via questionnaires, but we not only asked the adolescents themselves, but we also asked the parents. And we asked two specific questions for this study. We asked adolescents and their parents if they wished to be of the opposite sex or would like to be treated as someone from the opposite sex. Actually, the parent survey was done at 10 and the adolescent survey was done at the 13 to 15 age range.
Can you share some of the key findings from the research?
Tanya gave an overview of the Generation R study, which gave us a nice large sample of over 5,700 children who were born between 2002 and 2006 in the city of Rotterdam in the Netherlands. When we looked at this survey, we found out about 4% of these adolescents expressed some sort of discontentedness with their assigned sex at some point at around age 13 to 14 years, but even less than 1% of parents could actually report the same thing in their children. So in other words, we found that parents may not be aware of gender diversity feelings in their adolescents. We also found that adolescents assigned female at birth reported more gender variant experiences than those assigned male. And when we looked at mental health outcome in these children, we found positive associations between report of gender variant experiences and mental health outcomes such as anxiety, depression, and autistic traits. These findings did not differ between those who were assigned male or female at birth, so very similar.
Okay, let's unpick the findings a bit further. You point to an association between gender dysphoria and mental health symptoms in adolescents. Can you elaborate on the relationship between the two?
Yes. First, I want to clarify that we did not, actually, unfortunately, in this study, we were not able to study gender dysphoria. We rather studied gender diversity. So gender dysphoria really is a clinically significant distress or impairment. It's related to a strong desire to live as the other gender or the one that is incongruent with how they were, the sex they were assigned. Mm-hmm. What we did is we asked adolescents to express whether they wished to be the opposite sex. And at the time, asking if they felt distressed by the sex that they were assigned. So several studies have shown associations between gender dysphoria and mental health problems. What our study does is really extend this to the general population. And that's one of the advantages of these large population-based studies. Rather than just having the clinically referred samples, you also have the full spectrum of the full spectrum of the gender spectrum, but also the full spectrum of the behavior as well. So the thought, for example, I've worked quite a bit in studies looking at autism spectrum disorder, where also the thought is that symptoms of autism also extend into the general population, where you have children who are very severe, who would have met the criteria when I was a medical student, which was 2 to 5 per 20,000. Now it's 1 in 68. So at one time it was very severe. Now it's become more of a broader spectrum. So you have these groups that might have subclinical symptoms and aren't help seeking. And also in this gender spectrum as well. So we're looking at the relationship, not only in the help seeking group, but also across the entire population.
I was just going to ask whether that confounds things because some of the mental health symptoms may relate to autistic traits rather than gender diversity. Is that possible?
So we're not looking at causal relationship. We're defining an association. So the fact that a child can have autistic symptoms along a spectrum and gender diversity along a spectrum, we show that those two are related, but that doesn't mean that the underlying mechanism is the same. It may be. There might be factors that occur during prenatal life or early life that has similar mechanisms, especially when you think that autism, for example, has in itself occurs 4-to-1 males versus females. So there's something interacting in the brain with possible gender dimorphic features that are occurring. I just want to come back. We're showing a relationship and we're not defining causality. Other studies would have to look more closely to look at causal mechanisms for this relationship. Mm-hmm. It could be that the psychopathology is related to stigmatization and the negative consequences in certain societies of being different, having gender diverse experiences that I think is fortunately becoming less over time.
Well, you've mentioned two things. You've mentioned the fact that more females were likely to have gender variant experience than males. And then you also talked about higher autistic trait scores in the study. Let's focus on females first. What do you make of that finding, that more females were likely to have gender variant experience than males?
It was not a surprising finding, specifically based on what we see from clinical data that comes from a transgender clinic, because in transgender clinic, when investigating youth who come for transitioning, we see that those who were assigned female at birth, they have an overrepresentation in those samples. So that's why our data is just a confirmation that in this regard, also the same pattern exists in the general population. Why is that? We did not really study the underlying reason. It's just what we observed, that also in the general population, those assigned female, they also express more gender diversity across the spectrum.
And adolescents with gender variant experience at higher autistic trait scores, as you mentioned, what implications, if any, can be drawn from that?
This is a topic that when I've attended meetings directed towards the autism, that it's a topic that's had a lot of, I don't want to say publicity, but it's a topic that is commonly spoken about now at these conferences, and trying to understand why there's relationships, because this isn't a relationship that, I think what we've shown is that this relationship extends into the general population. Other studies have really highlighted that within samples of children with autism, they have higher rates of gender dysphoria. And in samples of children with gender dysphoria, there's higher rates of autism spectrum disorder. I have an ongoing study of eating disorders, and we're also looking at autism symptoms. And so it may be not all that specific, because we're seeing higher rates in that group as well. So what does it mean? I think it's a great question. So does it mean that there's, again, we're not looking at causality. I wish we could understand that more, but there could be different biological mechanisms, whether it's related to hormonal influences during early gestation or fetal brain development, estrogen signaling pathways. Those are questions that our study didn't address. We're looking at relationships within a broader population study. But the fact that we're looking within a larger population-based study, and that we see it not only on the extremes, but also in children with different levels of features, suggests that there's some leveling difference.
Thank you. I want to return to something you highlighted earlier. The paper shows that while less than 1% of parents reported that their children had gender variant experience, 4% of children reported this. Why, in your view, are parents often unaware of gender diverse feelings in their adolescents? And does parental awareness or attitudes make a difference in terms of mental health outcomes?
That's a good question. Well, our data suggests that parents might not always be aware of the gender diverse feeling in their adolescents. That's what the observation we had. Does parental awareness or attitude make a difference in terms of mental health outcome? Well, we did not study that directly, but if you think about it within the context of the minority stress framework, which is discussed for mental health outcome in the context of mental health outcome in gender diverse youth, we know that the experience of gender diverse children in general in their social environment, including their family, can contribute to their mental health outcome because of this distress. So if you think about that in that framework, you can argue that parents' awareness can make a difference in terms of mental health outcome. What we can do is that's the basis for several approaches to while children are going through, like navigating, you know, their path through understanding their gender identity, the best is to listen to children.
Great, thank you. Your study shows that parents with low or medium educational levels reported more gender variant experience in their children than those with higher education. I found that quite surprising. How do you account for that difference?
Well, for us, it was we account for these differences when we're looking at, for example, the relationship between gender diversity and mental health symptoms by adjusting for those factors in our analysis. We found differences in child self-report gender variant experiences by maternal education, not by paternal education. That was interesting. Also, something that I want to add that we found negligible differences among ethnic group or income level. That was something that we also saw in reports from Canada and the Netherlands. Again, this is a study that we did not really investigate the reasons for those differences, but I think those differences are informative. And as you said, we accounted for those when we're looking at, for example, why these kids are at higher risk of mental health outcomes in the future.
Edgar and Tonya, is there anything else in the paper that you'd like to highlight?
The one thing that I brought up before, I think is the strength of the study is the large sample size and the population base recruitment of the study. And when we've looked at how well the current cohort, because there's been some attrition over time, but how well the current cohort reflects the existing population, it actually reflects it quite well in spite of the attrition. I think we feel fairly confident that we've captured a multi-ethnic population-based cohort of Rotterdam, and Rotterdam might not necessarily be reflective of all of the Netherlands, or definitely, but in terms of a large city that captures many different aspects of multicultural, that's a strength of the study.
What are the implications of your findings for CAN professionals?
So I think the implications for those who are of child and adolescent mental health professionals are when you see children with psychiatric disorders, it's good to ask also about gender diverse experience as well, and vice versa, to explore those relationships. Your question really relates to implications for findings for child mental health professionals, but there, since it's a population-based study, there you could also say that is what are the implications for public health, which also could be a possibility from this study, because there are children who may not be help-seeking, who have maybe subclinical mental health issues that could benefit. And whether that's via education, via the school, via other mechanisms to reach out to these children could also be helpful.
It's a really important point to make. Are you planning some follow-up research that you can share with us?
So you're asking researchers if they're planning to do follow-up research. That's like a knee-jerk reflex. Sorry. So yes, we are. One of the limitations of our study is that we really relied on two questions that didn't really capture the spectrum. They were actually more binary questions about do you feel like you would rather be born as the opposite sex, and would you rather be treated as the opposite sex? So what we have an ongoing wave. So we have a longitudinal population-based study, and in our current wave, which is ongoing, we've added a measure that captures more of the full spectrum of gender diversity. So we also would like to look more closely at the MRI features of these experiences. And not only at the time that we're assessing them at 13 to 15, and then later at 17 to 19, COVID has put a delay in all of that, but also we have the opportunity to look back, because we have almost 4,000 scans that were collected from 9 to 11 years of age. And we also have over 1,000 in our first wave from 6 to 9 years of age. So we'll have the opportunity to look really longitudinal. Unfortunately, we don't have early measures of gender diversity.
Nonetheless, it would be really interesting to see those.
It would be, yeah, very interesting. Mm.
Is there anything else in the pipeline for either of you that you would like to mention?
I like to add that Tanya talked about future direction for research and what we're doing, mm-hmm. but at the same time, we are building connection with the community. We talk about a community that has been historically marginalized in the United States, in Europe, and many other countries. And for us, it's important, if you're doing research, you should be in constant communication and contact with the community to get feedback from them, to have their involvement. And also, we want to make sure that we disseminate the finding back to the community, because we want the community to benefit from the findings of our research as well.
And by the community, do you mean young people or also their family?
Family. And when you're talking about the LGBT, and in particular in this case, gender diverse children, usually families, parents are also involved. So that would be both children and their parents.
Anything in terms of anything coming up in the pipeline that you want to add?
You know, for me, the highlight of this research was that, you know, others have done this research in Canada, the US or Germany, and, you know, finding similar results in different countries suggests that, you know, despite the impact of societal factor, cultural factor, we know that the recognition of gender variant experiences in adolescence are quite stable across these cultures. And that is very important to know. And as researchers and healthcare providers, for us, understanding the contributing factors and also providing support when children and families are navigating through gender and sexual identity, our role is essential to be there and to support them.
Is support lacking at the moment in terms of that navigation that younger people and their parents and families are doing?
I believe so, despite all the effort. I mean, we can talk about advancements, but we can do better.
I just want to say that OCCAR has a Brain Behavior Research Foundation grant in order to explore this question further, together with me and Javier Castellanos at NYU. And we have a postdoc, Ilse Zerza, who is also working on this project. So we have some pilot funding to move the project forward, and we hope to get additional funding.
And finally, Akar and Tanya, what is your take-home message for those listening to our conversation?
I think I just want to repeat the same thing that I said. I think gender variant experiences in adolescence are quite stable across culture. And that's probably the most important message from this paper, the similarities of our findings with others.
Yeah, anything to add?
Oh, I just want to add that the discrepancy between youth reports and parents' knowledge of their youth, I think that also is quite interesting, and it would be important to follow up to see why that discrepancy does exist, between the youth and parent report.
Thank you both ever so much. For more details on Assistant Professor Akgar Kasabian and Professor Tanya White, please visit the ACAM website, www.acam.org, and Twitter at ACAM. ACAM is spelled A-C-A-M-H. And don't forget to follow us on your preferred streaming platform. Let us know if you enjoyed the podcast with a rating or review. And do share with friends and colleagues.
This podcast was brought to you by the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, ACAM for short.